You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. Over the summer, we're taking a break, so we've picked some of our favourite stories to play for you over the next few weeks. We'll be back with new episodes in February.
Hello, I'm Eugenia Subchenka. I'm a supervising producer of All the Best, and I'm currently reporting to you from the Yarra Valley, where it has temporarily stopped hailing, which is why you might hear some dripping sounds and some birds behind me. So the first episode I've picked for you today is one made by a bunch of our talented All the Best folks for the KCRW radio race in 2019. So this is where teams from all around the world compete to make a story based on a particular theme in only 24 hours. I love stories that draw our attention to things that we might never stop to think about, and this insight into the life of a cinema projectionist definitely falls in that category. Hope you enjoy.
It's a magical place. It is really magical, and it is really a world of its own. It's quite removed from nearly the rest of the theatre, and yes, it's like your own island up the back there in the dark in a box, you know, and all you get to look through is little 5-inch portholes to look at and peer at the audience and at the screen, and the rest of the time you're just secluded by yourself.
Kevin Adams got his first job in a cinema at 15.
Each reel goes 20 minutes, so depending on...
40 years on, he's still got a love for the craft of projection.
There's a bit of a mystery about projectionists, I suppose. Often because you're in a dark projection room up the back of a theatre, no one ever thinks of you unless something goes wrong. I remember as a kid sitting there thinking, oh, are the lights getting dim? Because they dim very slowly, and it was part of the excitement was going to the pictures and the lights going down and the footlights would be on the screen curtains, and then the curtains would part and the picture would hit the screen. And, you know, that's all done manually. It was all been done manually in the past.
A lot has changed since Kevin's early cinema experiences. We've slowly moved away from 35mm film and adopted digital alternatives. But for Kevin, it's not all about analogue versus digital.
So the showmanship, I feel, has dissipated, and it shouldn't, because the technology should be able to do everything, certainly more than even two people in projection can do, you know, who've only got two sets of hands.
As much as we have put our faith in digital projection, you can't code passion.
The projectionist actually has always been, up until now, the most important person in the building, because the projectionist actually can make or break your show. But it is a thankless job, because no one really looks back and thinks that there's someone up there toiling away over hot carbon arcs and changing reels and having to wind film forward and back.
After 20 years projecting onto the world's largest screen, the projectors in Kevin's cinema were all replaced with laser technology. With that, his position became redundant.
I did feel very neglected and put out. Like in any industry or any job, the reality is that it is a job. And it doesn't matter how dedicated you've been, how much you've given 100% of yourself to that business. When the day comes that they don't need you, then they will show you the door. The projection room to me is another room of my house. To actually hand back your keys and your pass so you could no longer just walk into the door anymore by choice without having to ask permission was pretty gut-wrenching. It was pretty awful, and I can understand how many of the projectionist friends I've got have been pretty devastated. 40 years is an awful long time, so I think I'm very lucky. You know, I've got my memories, so can't take it that way from me. You take away the projector, you can take away the film, but I still have the rest, so... Cinema will always be around because people do like to go out. We are social beasts. We do like to enjoy seeing a film unfold on a screen and having 200 people around you reacting or jumping or laughing, and that certainly can make a big difference. And knowing that that building brings so much happiness to people and transports them to another time and place outside of their own lives, it's a nice place to be. You know, I love it. I always have. I mean, you wouldn't keep doing it if you didn't.
Thanks to Kevin Adams for telling us his story. This piece was produced by Maddie McQueen, Erin Dick, and Lee Robinson as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story.
So this second story is a bit of surrealist fiction, which I really love, even though it's rather unusual for what we do usually at All the Best. It's inspired by the writings of Daniil Kalms, who's a surrealist Russian writer. He wrote kind of a lot of children's books, but also short adult fiction that had a very dark, twisted sense of humour, which you'll hopefully hear in this story. Strap yourself in for the ride.
Hi, is it just you today? Or?
No, table for two, please.
Okay, yeah. Can I get you a coffee while you wait?
A coffee would be good for now, yeah.
Okay, just take a seat and I'll bring it right out for you.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. You know, I brought a client here once. Not halfway through the meal when I get the yes. That's how good the food is. But anyways, yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for my stuff. I put my phone down in a cab and forget about it. Once I left my laptop in a client's meeting room, I was so impatient to just get out of there. Have I told you about the time my friend lost his glasses?
There once was a man who lost his glasses. He patted down his pockets, but they weren't there. He checked his bag, but they weren't there. He went down to the car park, thinking that he might have left it in his car, but they weren't there either. So he got in his car and stood still in traffic for 2 hours till he reached his office in Macquarie Park, but still, it wasn't there. "Have you seen my glasses?" he asked Jennifer, the research coordinator. But before she could answer, he went over to Martin and said, "Have you seen my glasses?" "Yeah, the game last night was hectic, eh?" Martin replied. But before he heard this, he went back home and wore his pajamas and popped onto the sofa. He watched television, hoping to find a news report on his lost glasses. Hearing nothing but the usual bloodshed, he switched to Netflix and watched Sugar Rush, which is a very good show about cakes. He opened a bag of corn chips and speculated, since he had checked everywhere else, his glasses must be in the bottom of the bag. So he ate all the corn chips that were in the way. His glasses were not in the bag. The man did this routine for many years, then died. No, his glasses weren't on his head. In fact, he never had any glasses. His funeral was attended only by the man's therapist, his doctor, and his optometrist. The optometrist made the remark that he always had very good eyesight.
20/20.
The doctor agreed. The therapist had little to say, since the man only ever attended one session.
Here's your coffee.
Oh, thank you.
Can I get you anything to eat as well?
No, not yet. Not yet. Yeah. Could I just have a table water?
Sure.
For now, yeah.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Excuse me. Yes.
Could you please check on our order? We've been here quite a bit. We're table number 19.
Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, so while I was there last summer, I did this beautiful hike in Aix-en-Provence. Incredible. I'll show you some photos. But the whole time I was there, I could only think about how the lake and all the mountains around them were slowly being destroyed by climate change. Couldn't enjoy myself at all.
Yeah, that must have been annoying. But it reminds me of this joke about a lake. Do you know it? It's like there are four men standing around a lake.
And one of them says, "What a magnificent landscape. I must capture it." This man was an artist. He took out his camera and took some pictures. After doing this, he was still very lonely, so he listened to a happy podcast till he fell asleep. "What an immense body of water," one other man said. "I must study it." He was a scientist, so he took out his plastic ruler and started measuring the circumference of the lake so as to calculate the displacement of water due to tidal forces. This was good, but he was still very bored. So he went home and watched Sugar Rush on Netflix, which is a very good show about cakes. "What a lake," one other man said. He did not say much more, but instead went on to invest some $1 million into building and managing a lakeside recreational complex. The profits were good, but he still felt empty inside, so he went back into town and ate some prescription drugs. I would tell you about the other man, but he and his friends ran off to play in the water. Splash, splash.
Here's your water.
Thank you.
Everything good? Do you want me to get you anything else?
No, but actually I'm waiting for a lady in a red coat. If you see her come in, could you just direct her to this table? It's pretty busy here, so I can't actually see the door.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
I can do
Thank
that.
Thank you. Thank you. There once was a man who kept his heart in a glass jar next to an orchid. He would carry the jar wherever he went and say to others, "Look at my heart. Look at how frail it is. Look at how pathetically it whimpers with every pulse. I am haunted by the tyranny of the murder of crows that encircle it every night, casting dark shadows on its fate. Oh, what shall I do? What shall I do? Would you be so kind as to take it from me? Give it shelter and feed it love? It's a special gift from me to you." Everybody found this routine to be supremely annoying. "Do you mind putting your heart back into your chest?" they would proclaim. "It's very unhygienic." One day the man died. The neighbors were quite glad upon hearing this, since they did not like him hanging around their kids. The banker said that the man died because his heart was outside his body. The baker said that it was because his heart was outside his body. The barber, too, was of the opinion that it was indeed because his heart was outside his body that he died. Snip, snip. To settle their curiosity, the doctors opened up his chest, and just as everyone had hoped, there was nothing there. The doctors, with a good degree of certainty, determined the cause of death: heart exterior to chest cavity. In fact, they were amazed at how he had managed to stay afoot this long, but quickly, so as not to shatter their stethoscopes, they dismissed the thought as an anomaly.
Hey, good to see you. Hey.
How's it going?
I'm good. I'm sorry I'm late.
Oh, no, that's totally fine. That's totally fine.
Yeah. It was the bus, and then I just couldn't find where the stop was, and now, yeah.
You wanna sit down, or...
Yeah. I mean, are you having a coffee?
Yeah. Just had one.
Okay.
Could go for another one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm just gonna run off to the bathroom real quick.
Yeah. That's fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll just be right here. There once was a creature called human being that was never quite content with being. The trouble began when it mistook its heart for a squishy apple and threw it out from the tree. Its heart disappeared like a pair of lost glasses. Humans chased the heartbeat from Tanzania to New Zealand. It was no use. Instead, it filled its empty heart hole with whatever it had lying around. It filled it with sticks and leaves, then cherries and meat. Some filled it with paper and ink and acrylic paint. Some filled it with silicon and silicone and silly putty. Some filled it with Sugar Rush, airing on Netflix. Some filled it with love and ladies in red coats.
You're listening to All the Best. We're taking a break over the next few weeks, so we're going to play you some of our favourite stories over the summertime. We'll be back with brand new episodes in February.
Hi, this is Ryan Pemberton. I'm the EP, and this story that I've chosen this week is called To Jeffrey by Bernadette Nguyen. And this one is about dogs. Which is why I like it, because I like dogs. Dogs are really good, and you should like dogs too. It's also an important
relationship, I think, the one that you have with your childhood dog, particularly if you're looking after the dog, it's like the first time that you are responsible for caring for another living thing. And that bond can be quite special. And so when that thing that you're responsible for the life of dies, it can be really painful and difficult to let go of. And the way that people deal with that, well, people deal with it in lots of different ways. And that's what Bernadette explores in this story. I hope you enjoy it.
Can you describe Larry to me?
Dead.
Well, do you remember what he looks like?
This is my little niece. Earlier last year, we had to put a dog down. He had been in the family since I was 15. He was the reason I became obsessed with the idea of getting my own dog. 2 years later, my sister and I got Jeffrey.
Can you describe Jeffrey to me?
Just so handsome. He's so handsome. He's so sweet.
Well, I meant like breed and...
Oh! He's got hazel brown eyes, caramel coat, gorgeous smile. Oh, he's a Labrador. Jeffrey's a Labrador, 12 years old, almost 12.
And at almost 12, he is a senior dog. Soon after Larry's passing, Jeffrey started to behave weirdly.
He would follow us around really closely, head down, and he would yelp really randomly, and we couldn't figure out where the pain was originating from.
2 weeks later, we were rushing him into emergency.
And the sweet thing is that even though he was in a lot of pain and he was crying from pain and couldn't move because of the pain, he was still wagging his tail every time you would talk to him or, you know, call his name.
The vet gave us our options. And to be honest, I don't really remember them. Potential diagnoses and treatment costs were being thrown around while Jeffrey was basically paralyzed. And then my sister started talking about the worst case scenario.
He was just in so much pain, I was already prepared to limit his suffering, which was already quite upsetting in itself.
We love bragging about how healthy Jeffrey is. For a Labrador, he's what people call skinny and what vets call a healthy weight range. And because of that, we didn't think that we would have to put him down so soon.
But fortunately, he did get better. And the fear of having to put him down, the tough decision that we could have to have made, just went away.
Ever since that incident, I've been trying my hardest to give him the best final years of his life. I know there will come a day where I will probably have to say goodbye. And I'm not really sure how I will cope.
Toto was a Maltese cross poodle, so a little white thing, but he definitely wasn't that stereotype of a fluffy white puppy. He was very much the alpha male, so would always be the one humping in the park, much to my dismay and embarrassment. Very loved in this family, a bit like my baby brother, because I'm an only child, so that was always something I called him, like he was like the Stitch to my Lilo.
This is my friend Amelia. Earlier this year, she watched her childhood dog pass away.
Mum sort of came rushing in to my room and said, there's something wrong with Toto. And I sort of shot straight up. And Toto was lying, in our backyard on his side. His tongue had sort of fallen out of his mouth and his eyes were rolling. And his heart was slowing down. I think I basically caught him at his last heartbeat or breath. We basically sort of concluded that he'd had a heart attack. Dad immediately started digging a hole, and sort of while we were waiting for Dad to finish, I went outside and sort of held him. He looked very silly dead. I kept saying that to him. His tongue was out and his eyes were still a bit open, and he just looked so silly. He was always a goofy dog, so it felt quite apt for him to look that way in death. We buried him with a couple of treats as well and some flowers from around the garden. We said a few words, something along the lines of just thank you for being just the loveliest dog. Because I mean, Toto and I sort of grew up together. He was with me for, you know, the best part of my childhood, really.
I know how much Toto meant to her. I remember her posting videos of him sitting beside her when she played piano. I can only imagine how empty the house must feel now.
So it's been 2 months since Toto has passed away now. In between that, I went to America for about 3 weeks. I think grief hit me really hard. I had no idea the emotional sort of baggage that I would carry around with me on a supposed summer holiday. In the week before I left for America and in the weeks after, I found it quite hard to be at home or come home if I was out. And even to get out of bed in the morning, that was really hard as well.
Hello.
Hello, is that Samantha?
Speaking.
Oh, hi, it's Bernadette. How are you?
I was curious about the other ways people deal with losing a pet.
My name is Samantha Chavinsky and I am a taxidermist. I've been doing pets now for about 4 years. I could do so many more pets than I do now if I had the room. I would be flat out. There is such a huge demand for it.
I'd never considered taxidermy. I always thought that getting your pet stuffed was mainly for old and lonely people, but Samantha told me otherwise.
Some people who get their pets done are quite young adults, so they're getting a pet done that they've grown up with. I can't really think of any other reasons why they would do it, other than that they don't want to end their story with that pet at that point in time.
Samantha has a lot of pets.
I have cats, dogs, chickens, guinea fowls, peacocks, goats.
So you're probably wondering, would she ever taxidermy her own pets?
I don't think I could do my dog, for example. He's been with us for nearly 8 years. I couldn't do him. I'd rather just bury him and that would be it. The cat I have, because it's a striking coloured cat, so it's beautiful to me. It should be on display, but yeah, that's my reason.
I assume Samantha would have to deal with grief on the regular. I wanted to know how this affected her. She told me that death is inevitable, but recreating the personality of their pet helps the grieving process for her clients. She sees it purely as a job. But there were times when the grief began to affect her.
I mean, an example was a young German Shepherd puppy I was picking up down in Melbourne, and I thought the dog was going to be deceased when I got there, but it was actually, I was picking it up from the vet and the dog was still alive when I got there. And I was like, oh, I haven't dealt with this before. It was quite shocking. They were actually having the dog put down that day. The dog was in obvious pain, which was something that I couldn't understand why. I think that's what affected me more than anything, was because why would you prolong this dog's suffering? The weird thing about it was when I was there and she was laying on the floor because she couldn't walk, she actually got up and crawled over to me and licked my hand before they put her down. I would talk to it and everything while I was working, and it was quite weird. But I guess because I knew what she'd gone through before she passed away, that affected me and I said I'd never do that again.
But even with the bad experiences, to Samantha, the job was still worth it.
I do get letters occasionally from people thanking me for what I've done. And I've done pets from people in Queensland and Perth and South Australia. And they send me nice little messages that they're happy and they recommend me to other people.
I can picture myself carrying around a taxidermy Jeffrey, as much as my family and friends would hate it. But I don't think I could do it, because the idea of a stuffed Jeffrey staring at me while I sleep terrifies me. Our family had a dog long before Jeffrey. His name was Lewis, and he was a sweet Rottweiler. My parents worked long hours, and he was in the hands of very young children.
Yeah, it was very difficult to deal with Lewis's passing, and you know, I still look back on Lewis's life and how he raised him, and still have regrets, because admittedly, we didn't know how to look after a dog. We knew that he enjoyed walks, but we didn't walk him nowhere near as much as he should have. And we didn't feed him the best diet either. Lewis didn't get to choose what he ate. Lewis didn't get to choose how often he got to exercise. It was all on us. That's what made his death even harder, knowing that it was essentially our fault.
But my sister wanted to reassure me that Jeffrey's passing would be different.
Jeffrey, he's in his senior years. He's had a really good life. He's a picture of health, according to the vet, aside from a couple issues, dental issues, a little bit of back pain. He has a good life, and so if he does pass, I do feel better knowing that he lived the best life we could possibly have given him.
And I'm so happy to know that I've made Jeffrey happy. To be honest, putting this story together has brought me to tears. I love Jeffrey so much. I know that there will be a time where I will have to say goodbye, and I know that it'll be hard. What happens after I say goodbye?
My parents and I started talking about getting another dog, pretty quickly after Toto passing. We very much noticed the absence or the silence of like another little body running around the house. And so about exactly a week ago, my parents went out to Kingsway, which is near Doonside, and went to the same shop that we got Toto, but it had moved. They got a little pup called Archie, who is a Cavalier cross poodle, 3 months old, and now he's living with us. One of the main differences is that when I move out, Archie will be living with me, and that is a move that we'll make together sometime next year probably. And I think that'll be a learning curve for both of us, because, you know, leaving the nest is huge, and also Archie will have to get used to a new place as well. And I think that's an adventure I'm quite excited about.
Do you think you'll be sad when Jeffrey dies?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he's a doggie. And I like doggies.
We haven't had to a week ago today, you know.
All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe. We'll be back with new episodes in February.